Welcome to the Fuller Money Audio Commentary. This is David Fuller on Friday the 6th of January, recording at 9:22 p.m., and that's Greenwich Mean Time. Now, this being Friday, this is the big picture long-term outlook at the various asset classes, but first let's have a quick review of the week. Well, it was a New Year holiday shortened week for many stock markets, but it started with a bang, and then we've been seeing some consolidation for stock markets following those initial gains. That included today. The Asian markets were mixed, with perhaps a few more down than up, although the depressed China A-shares scored a modest gain. And European indices were mostly lower in here today. The UK index was an exception, but up less than half a percentage point today. The Americas, we had a very quiet day here for a change. And the S&P down a quarter of 1%. The NASDAQ index up slightly more than that. Now, in long-dated government bond prices, we saw them come off their highs in the futures markets this week. There was somewhat steadier action in here today. And the dollar has been quite strong, and not least against the euro, I think it would be better to phrase that as saying the euro has fallen against absolutely everything in here, save a couple of suspect emerging market currencies, which I'm unable to recall at this hour. But it's certainly, the euro has certainly been weaker against all the major currencies. The Chinese renminbi has been strong. Precious metals have been, well, gold and silver, I should say, have been generally steady. It was a pretty good rally from a short-term oversold condition, but that appears to have stalled in the last couple of days, including today. We're trading after hours here with silver down 60 cents, 28.70, and gold bullion is down 580 at just below 16.17. Although that's well off the earlier lows that we saw here today. Crude oil has been strong, and a little bit worryingly so, in fact. And we've got Brent tonight at 113 and change, and we've got the WTI at 101.76. It's actually down a fraction at the moment. It was up at 102.80 earlier in the day. The grains and grain and bean complex had a very strong rally before the corn, wheat, and soybeans ran out of steam yesterday. Rough rice has been steady. Also a good rally. In talking about the dollar strength, it hasn't done all that much against the Asian dollar index, I should point out. Okay, so what do we make of all this? Well, in terms of global stock markets, I'm encouraged by the technical action that we have seen. As you probably know, if you've been listening to these audios, there are no grounds for complacency, as we're still range-bound for most of these indices. And range-bound markets are hard to predict, other than they're likely to extend the range somewhat further before you get to eventually see a decisive breakout of those ranges. But the balance of technical evidence suggests that breakout from the range is more likely to be up than down. And the reason for that is the base building activity following the climactic selling in August, and establishing lows which were retested and marginally exceeded in September and October for most of the important stock markets. And then subsequently, we've seen a succession of higher reaction lows for the U.S. indices, for most of the European indices, and for some of the smaller Asian stock market indices, and for Brazil, interestingly, among the important, well, certainly being the most important Central and South American market. We've seen real strength in other markets from that region, from including Mexico and Argentina, and against South Africa. It's another market right up near its highs of last year. The ASEAN stock markets also. Now, of course, there are others. There are the there's the underperformance of the of China. That's the most serious one. And the underperformance of the European periphery markets, for the most part. Underperformance by Australia is a concern, although it looks to me like it's support building overall. But I'm glad to say that most of this technical evidence is consistent with a hypothesis that we've outlined here for the last few months, saying that it looked as if the cyclical bear market was over. And if the cyclical bear market is over, then virtually by definition, we are in the early stages of a cyclical bullish phase. And I feel that the scope from here onwards is more likely to favor a move to the upside for most of these markets. In other words, I think we'll get the year is more likely to pleasantly surprise than not. Now, there are lots of ifs, so let's run through some of that. One of the key planks here is the very accommodative monetary conditions that we have in North America and also in Europe. That's not going to change this year, or I find it inconceivable that it will. And I think the central bankers, the ECB and the Fed would find it inconceivable that that will change significantly, if at all, here this year. So that's a good tailwind. Valuations are quite reasonable. And yes, valuations have been higher historically, and yes, we are in a valuation contraction cycle, as I've often mentioned on Wall Street, but we're well beyond the midpoint of that valuation contraction cycle, and that values don't need to see a valuations don't need to see a big stock market fall to contract, although that'll certainly do the trick. But they can also contract when earnings growth is better than the rate of stock market appreciation. And I wouldn't be surprised. Well, that has been a factor in here over the last few years, as one would expect in a valuation contraction cycle, which Fuller Money has talked about since the NASDAQ bubble, tech bubble burst in 2000. So I think that will go on for a few more years. And on some of the PowerPoint reports that I've produced, I had penciled in on the charts demonstrating that, really, that it might well run to 2017, but possibly a little bit longer. We also have the factor that following all the historic evidence, and I've mentioned this on a number of occasions, is that all the historic evidence shows that following a credit crunch recession, that it really does take 5 to 7 years before you get back to where you were beforehand, and it can take longer, as we've certainly seen with Japan. So those are factors that should prevent us from getting carried away in here. But, you know, you net it all out, and I think things look pretty good relative to expectations that we had last year, and even that we still have as we are in the early days of the new year. For instance, there was a big and very vocal consensus that the U.S. either hadn't come out of recession or was certainly going to experience a double-dip recession last year. Well, why didn't that actually happen? And I can cite reasons. I think a very important reason is the development of U.S. oil shale and oil gas, which has kept those prices lower in the United States than they have been elsewhere. And importantly for the United States, it pushed pushed the gasoline prices down, although they have steadied in recent weeks. They've lost downward momentum in recent weeks. The quantitative easing from the Fed has certainly helped to cushion the U.S. economy and enable it to be stronger than it would have been without that quantitative easing. And that's not an unqualified vote in favor of quantitative easing, because I maintain that that was done at the considerable risk of an inflation problem when the U.S. economy does eventually begin to show some robust growth at some stage later on in this decade. And the other factor, the third factor, I think that has helped the U.S. to avoid a recession last year and currently, and I don't expect it to dip back into recession this year unless we get a big spike in the oil price, which I'm hopeful that we can avoid. It's a risk, but I'm hopeful we can avoid it. More on that in a moment. But the third factor is the strength of the growth economies. Although they have slowed, that growth has slowed over the last year, it's still pretty reasonable, and they have been importing U.S. goods and services. So that's given the U.S. a relatively stellar performance compared to what we see in Euroland. And Euroland has the bigger problems, the sovereign debt crisis, Europe's banking crisis. Look at the difference between the performance of the banking index in Europe, which after the declines that we've seen in the last 2-3 days is still ropey. And the better strength that we've seen coming from the U.S. banks, which Owen incidentally reviewed here today. So, again, the U.S. in a stronger position than Europe. But Europe's, again, we don't want to confuse companies with the economies. I think the European economy is, I agree with the consensus that it's going to remain weak. And I also think that it's very likely, so I agree with the consensus that the euro will weaken further. And it needs to. That would be good for some of these struggling European economies. And the other factor is that really, the ECB's quantitative easing has only just begun. So it's behind in dealing with these problems. But again, to repeat the point, I don't want to confuse the economies with the individual shares. And Owen has in his good contribution, another good contribution here today, has highlighted some of the companies in Italy, for instance, which are doing considerably better than their indices. But the banks remain the Achilles heel, and we know that there is no quick solution to the European debt problems overall. They will inflate a lot of that debt away. They will write off a portion of that debt, as they've already done with some of Greece's debt, and I think there'll definitely be more of that overall. But bottom line here, we're not getting the collapse of the euro that we often mentioned was a consensus forecast, not least in the United States, with which Owen and I have never agreed. So I think the euro will muddle along because it's a political construct, and arguably not the wisest political construct in terms of economic viability, but that was never the reason why the euro was created to begin with. It was to prevent these countries from waging war with each other, and this had been planned really before the embers of World War II were cold. And there's a huge will within the European community to preserve the euro. I do maintain that we'll see somebody drop out of the euro at some stage. I would say no country is going to be thrown out, but we may see a degree of civil unrest over austerity programs. Greece is an obvious candidate for this in the next few years, which will lead to a referendum, which will cause those countries to Greece is the only one I've mentioned, but it could also happen with Portugal. I'd be surprised if any others were serious candidates to do that. And then that certainly wouldn't be the end of the world here overall. Now, moving around the globe, Asian-led growth, I think, is going to improve because we will get a further easing of monetary policy in the region. China, though, is the big influence here, and there's a growing crescendo of worry over China. And China's big underperformance has surprised me, although, you know, we were quick to point out the monetary tightening that occurred in China, and we were quick to point out the massive supply increase in terms of equities, which have weighed on that market for quite a long time, and those have continued. I think last month there was a huge insurance company float in China. So it's been absolutely massive, more than twice the rate of flotation that we've seen on Wall Street. And of course, China is a much smaller market in terms of total capitalization. What is it? I think it's about a quarter of the size, but I'm not sure on that. But it's significantly smaller. Now, the valuations, though, are some of the most attractive that we've seen within the last 20 years. And that should be bullish, but we don't see it yet in the chart. So that is a concern. Let's see. We've seen long periods of underperformance by China in the past. And I don't yet see the technical evidence of a good recovery, although I think we've fallen to a level where when we even exceeded the level where I thought that was perhaps likely was likely to occur. And I'm certainly not becoming more bearish of China as it goes down, but I am surprised and disappointed that it's taken that long for the market to start to pick up again. And I just hope the authorities, monetary authorities, haven't held back for too long. I'm reluctant to go the route of saying that the underperformance of the stock market is a reliable indicator of more skeletons than have already been widely discussed. We may well see a hard landing in China's property market, but that's normal for property markets, but I certainly don't think we're going to see a hard landing for China's economy. And evidence to support that, I would say, has been the voracious demand for luxury goods. I mean, they have those companies, luxury good manufacturers in Europe and the United States, were a star performing sector last year. Well, the big buying was coming from Asia. Okay, and Asia's balance sheets are in much better shape than those of the West. Now I'm talking about government balance sheets overall. The West looks good in terms of its autonomies, and they continue to perform. I when once we get a significant improvement in animal spirits, and you'll have to have all the U.S. indices up above their highs of last year and holding those gains before that actually takes place. But then I think we'll see some of the mid-cap to smaller cap shares start to perform as animal spirits return. But we're not there yet. Long-dated government bond prices. The safe haven appeal will dissipate along with in the face of the reality of the unattractive yields in historic terms, and also because the bet that the US is going to follow Japan, or to follow Japan's path, rather, is not that attractive in my view. In other words, I don't think it's likely for the US. If any regional bloc follows Japan, it's going to be Europe, not the US, and it will be the Eurozone, not the US, in my opinion. I could talk more about that, but I don't want to abuse you too much in the length of this audio. Now, gold. Well, first, we have to consider that in the context of the US dollar, which I think is going to remain firm against sterling and particularly against the euro. But I think as GDP growth improves, and people are become more confident about Asia, that Asia's growth is no longer slowing, and then I think we will see the Asian currencies firming up once again, led by the renminbi. Well, that's already strong, and but the Singapore dollar would be another one that I would expect to be quite strong. Now, the weakness of some of those currencies, including the Indian rupee, makes the stock markets in that region even more interesting. I've written and talked about India sufficiently in here not to spend much time on it right now, but it's still got an image problem, and therefore in the global beauty contest, and that's what investment's about, or I've often said over decades that one should view equities from the perspective of a judge at an international beauty contest. And if you say, well, isn't that subjective? Then look at the charts, look at the chart action and relative strength. There's nothing subjective about that in terms of interpreting it. Okay. So, gold generally is caught between behaving like a safe haven, which it has for much of the last 11 years, and particularly as an alternative currency, which it certainly is, and more recently, as investment demand has become by far the main driver of the secular bull market in the gold price, it has shown a tendency to behave as a risk asset. So it's wearing those various hats in here, and it's a little bit it's like a juggling act, you know. It's in terms of which hat is actually in hand at any given time. We'll blink and it changes. And gold is still vulnerable to a further corrective phase, although I don't think it's the downside risk is all that big. Makes it very tricky in terms of futures trading, as I know to my cost. But I think that I had an email on this. So should one be buying gold below the $1,600 level? And I don't see any evidence. We got down to 1520, I or thereabouts, I think, both in September and last month before the latest short-term oversold rally, which has corrected that short-term oversold condition. Owen and I have talked about the comparison with 2008, when we saw gold fall by approximately a third, and that would take it down to around 1380. Well, will we get that far or a little bit further? That's probably the outside extreme that I would forecast at this stage, but I wouldn't be at all surprised to see it weaken a little bit further or remain range bound. But I say, in all honesty, in all candor, that this is tough to interpret now because it's lost its trend consistency, and that is anybody who works with charts will know that really a consistent trend is a self-feeding trend, and therefore it's easy to work with, relatively easy to forecast. You can look like a genius doing it for people who don't understand what you're doing. But recognizing those self-feeding, reoccurring trending characteristics. And that's what we've seen with a lot of the autonomies over the last year, for instance. Once that consistency is lost during a medium-term correction or worse, and gold is certainly in a medium-term correction, then it's much, much more difficult to analyze. And that's a reality that just has to be accepted and addressed. So one needs to be a little bit more careful. But I don't see any evidence that the secular bull market is over, and I think that it'll be, given all the money printing that we've seen, and given the historically low interest rates that we have in the West, and given the near certainty that interest rates are going to come down in the growth economies, that's a tailwind for gold. And as GDP growth picks up, the inflation pressures will also pick up, and I that's a favorable, that's a bullish long-term background I'm for the gold price. When we really have to be most careful about gold is when all the really dramatic cheerleading is occurring and the aggressive forecasts are coming out. You may recall back in August and September that some people were talking about gold going to $100,000. Well, is that analytical? And we're not talking about the next century. In the next century, I have absolutely no doubt that gold will do that. We may not live long enough actually find out whether my forecast of that is correct or not. But the point I'm trying to make is as I smile at my microphone here is that extreme forecasts are always up or down, are always a contrary indicator. And the level of conviction expressed is usually a contrary indicator. People just do that to reassure themselves and influence others. Okay, moving on. This oil situation. This is the big wild card here in terms of global prospects. Now, I find it very easy to argue that the price of crude oil is going to fall significantly in real terms, meaning inflation adjusted. Just read some of the pieces that I'm putting up today on the Bakken shale reserves. The U.S., incidentally, has the largest known reserves of shale oil. And its reserves of shale gas are second only, known reserves are second only to those of China. So the U.S. really is in a strong position in terms of energy development. Now, the current administration has permitted the shale and shale oil and shale gas development to proceed, although not as fast as it would do in other circumstances overall. And a basic view, and I'm not taking a political view in saying this, but the Obama administration has quite clearly been very concerned that the rapid development of the U.S.'s own oil and gas reserves, which are considerable, would delay or defer the development of alternative forms of energy. I think it's always a little bit tricky when governments start deciding policies like that rather than the market. And my own view on this, and I'll quote Owen on it. I hope I quote it, I'll at least be able to paraphrase it accurately. Or he said, the only reason for having wind and solar power is that they aren't fossil fuels right now. You're talking about it at today's, with today's technology. The only sensible reason why you would want solar and wind power is because they are not fossil fuels. In other words, they're not economic remotely. And the technology, while it's come a long way, is still quite crude. And therefore, there's a risk that we see economies severely hampered by the concentration of these industries. Now, there is a view that this is absolutely essential in terms of the survival of the planet. And I say in part of the trade-off, we need to use these things more cleanly. In other words, I'm all for emission controls. You will see some environmental problems, we already are, with the wind farms and with solar power overall. And again, I think the consequences in terms of very poor a very poor economic outlook by facing major energy shortages are horrendous. So I don't think that's going to happen. I'm more optimistic than that. But I think Europe's going to suffer because even France, which was the one country that really moved aggressively into nuclear power, so much so that for the last 2 decades or more, it's been receiving over 70% of its electricity from nuclear power, has not had a serious accident. And yet, according to polls I've seen, that the majority of French people following Fukushima want it phased out. Well, what's it going to be replaced with? They've also banned fracking for shale gas or shale oil in France. So that's not so good. And Germany's in a similar position, and it doesn't have the nuclear power capacity that France has. So I think that's a and that means that Europe is going to be more dependent, become more dependent on imports. The U.S. really ought to be self-sufficient in oil. All it has to do is push ahead and produce more of what those huge reserves that it actually has. And that doesn't mean that we give up on developing the alternatives. Far from it. I think some of the profits and some there should be government subsidies in terms of the research. And I think it would behoove companies, giant oil giants, to be doing their own research into renewables, all different forms of renewables. But I think you go on with your research and development program until you come up with something that's economically viable. We haven't done that. What we've seen is we've had uneconomic systems foisted on us, and that's not a great idea in my view. So, how countries actually manage their energy policies is in my opinion, going to be a crucial factor here going forward. But I think it's inevitable that we will see a majority of countries with significant shale oil and gas reserves, and a good many countries do, not least China. But in Europe, Poland, Ukraine, huge reserves. There'd be a long list. I think we'll see a press to develop much more of that over the next few years. And eventually, that will leave the world less vulnerable to oil spikes. But this is the second consecutive decade in which we do face supply problems. And this recent rally that we've seen in the price of crude oil, this is not due to a surge in demand, that's for sure. But it is due to the bellicose statements that we see from Iraq, I beg your pardon, from Iran, bellicose statements from Iran, firing missiles, talking about blocking the Straits of Hormuz. Then we have the uncertainty over Iraq. Hopefully Iraq will stabilize, but there's also a risk that it won't, and so there's concern over that, and that's helped to contribute to a backwardation in the prices of both WTI and Brent crude. And then there's degree of instability and religious tension in Nigeria. So to offset that, the good news is that we've got Libyan production improving at a good rate. But it's a tense situation here overall, and the real game changer, it's always been the case. But the real game changer here is that another spike in crude oil would is just something that the global economy cannot afford at this time. Now, I know a lot of people feel that a military strike against Iran is imminent. I don't. It would be madness for the United States to do that. The Obama administration is certainly not going to do that. And it's going to be in power right up until the next president is sworn in January 2013, or Obama is sworn in once again, in which case he'll be around longer. They're certainly not going to do that. And the Israelis are certainly not going to do it, in my opinion, without the blessings of the United States administration, which they would not get. So I think a lot of the bellicosity coming from Iran is just to signal that any interference in their nuclear program, well, it's to get people to back off here, basically. I think there will be interference, but let them do it with computers. As they have, as they or covertly, as they have, and will no doubt continue to do so. Okay, I don't want to digress too much on that. I'll let this run on for too long. But the again, oil price spikes, all bets for stock markets and global GDP growth are off while that persists. You've seen that over and over again. And you saw it in 2008, and you saw it last year, following a surge in oil prices during the first quarter of the year. So, if oil fears, tensions in the producing countries, if those abate so that the price can fall back, $20 below current levels, it would be a nice tailwind for the global stock market, all other things being equal. As they probably would be. Now, China, once the China market breaks its clear lengthy medium-term downward trend, watch for a simultaneous strengthening in the industrial commodity markets, other than oil. I'm talking about the industrial metals, lumber, so on. That will happen. We're still in a secular bull market in commodities, I believe. But the secular bull market in commodities, and I've said this for over a decade, well over a decade, will be punctuated by big cyclical fluctuations, and those will coincide. Downward fluctuations will coincide with slowdown in the global economy. But the secular bull, I say, is very much alive, and every time we get GDP growth synchronized in an expansion phase, inflation pressures will build up fairly quickly. Right now, we're not synchronized in a global GDP growth phase, so those commodity inflation pressures have been abating. I think I better draw a line under this. I think I've covered most of the main bases. I hope I have. At any rate, one last thing I'll mention is in this grain and bean complex. I have heard from one of your fellow subscribers who specializes in this area that the report coming out next Thursday for corn will indicate a significant drop in reserves, which would be bullish for the price. Trouble is, the price of corn is rose over a dollar until its high a couple of days ago. So it's correcting a short-term overbought condition at the moment. And on that note, have a fabulous weekend. All the best.